It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In the fall of 1993, the Bouncing Baby Food Network hit the airwaves for the first time. At the time, some culture watchers found it a little out there, a whole network about people cooking food? Come on.
But the Food Network beams its food content into 100 million homes these days and launched the careers of celebrity chefs like Rachael Ray and Emeril Lagasse. And joining us now with a scoop on the Food Network is Alan Sulkin. He's the author of From Scratch, Inside the Food Network. Alan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. Thrilled to be here.
Well, so in 1993, watching people cook stuff in prime time seemed a little out there. What was the response?
Well, there was only 6.5 million houses right then getting it, and the response was basically, thankfully, a resounding silence. A lot of what they were putting on the air was so awful.
What was wrong with it? What were they doing wrong when they first started it off?
Well, if you remember back in the early 90s, there was only about 25, maybe 30 cable channels, and everybody knew that there was going to be this the coming 500-channel universe, basically the world we live in now, which is then now rapidly becoming the 5-jillion-channel universe. But back then, they were just looking for ideas to start channels. And so these guys in Providence, Rhode Island, who worked for the cable company, who weren't even into food, just thought food would be a good business play. And they attracted investors and eventually started this network in a rush because they were worried that somebody else would get the idea. So, you know, one of the first shows was a talk show with Robin Leach from Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Wow, that sounds really random now compared to what the lineup is. What else was on there?
Well, there was a daily news show, which actually was sort of a precursor to The Chew. It just took 20 years to get it right, and this was originally called Food News and Views, and it had a great food guy, but not a great TV guy, named David Rosengarten. And it had, and his co-host was Donna Hanover, then Donna Hanover Giuliani, the First Lady of New York. So it was a pretty random, assemblage of programming. And Emeril Lagasse, who of course founded the best early show that got them on the map years later, Emeril Live, was on his first show, which was called How to Boil Water. The founding president of the network was a guy named Reese Schonfeld, who had also founded CNN. And Reese did not even have a kitchen. He and his wife had the kitchen removed. This is an only in New York kind of thing. They'd had their kitchen removed so they could fit dog food and a coffee maker, basically, and more shoes. So anyway, Reese had a friend who was getting divorced, and that guy said, well, what we really need is a show to teach the basics. So Emeril Lagasse's first show was literally pour water in pot, turn on heat, make sure pilot light is lit.
So that was, you know, sort of the early days of, you know, of cooking on TV. Is it something that was just sort of confined to public television back then?
That's right. Back then, it was sort of the food TV ghetto was the weekend mornings on public television. Even there was producers who were pitching to public TV and saying, you know, there's a lot of hunger for this, but the executives there were very elitist and just believed it belonged in the mornings and, you know, said things, sorry, public radio, but said that, you know, we are the network of Nova and the NewsHour. You know, we have quite enough cooking. But the big stars then were actually the frugal gourmet, Jeff Smith, who unfortunately fell on hard times towards the end of his life, and Martin Yan, and of course whatever reruns they were running of the great Julia Child. And so, you know, the opportunity to – the idea that anyone would even want to watch this stuff in prime time – was viewed very skeptically by a lot of investors and by a lot of people.
Now, Emeril has not made it through to the present-day Food Network, but as you said, he was sort of one of these very first early stars, and I want us to take a listen to what it was like. This is Emeril Live.
All right! So the question is, how's everybody in Chicago doing tonight? Emeril Lagasse here. Want to let you guys at home on a little secret. The real reason that people come to Chicago is for the food.
Yes.
Yes. It's not those cows on the street there, Mom. Tonight I'm cooking up some Chicago favorites, such as an incredible Chicago-style Italian sausage and pepper deep dish pizza.
Yeah! Oh, yeah.
Rhoda's over here going, Some classic Chicago hot dogs, and then I'm going to kick it up notches unknown to mankind with a killer porterhouse steak served with an overstuffed baked potato.
And Emeril's always kicking it up a notch, isn't he? That was sort of his tagline. And one of the things watching this clip, you know, I've seen Emeril before, but I was really struck by the people in the audience. Yeah. They were like, it was like seeing the Beatles, kind of. I mean, these people were going nuts for Emeril.
It was, weirdly, it was a lot like seeing the Beatles. And it was actually even recorded not far from the Ed Sullivan Theater in New York, where the Beatles made their first American appearance. Yes, the crowd, listen to that crowd. Emeril... It was the Tonight Show, you know, meets a cooking show, and he was spreading news that people did not know before in America. The great food was sort of confined to these urban areas, maybe Berkeley, Los Angeles, downtown New York. I mean, obviously there was interesting food being cooked, you know, in a lot of ethnic enclaves everywhere, even Wisconsin. But for the most part, this sort of new American cuisine was limited, and it was the Food Network which kind of discovered this nascent American food scene and then presented it to the masses. And it allowed it to spread, you know, to the point now where there's a Food Network kiosk at Lambeau Field, you know, serving more than hot dogs, and you know, more even stadium food is better. And by the time that Emeril show started, the network had finally, you know, broken through to about 20-30 million homes of being carried. So, you know, there was enough people getting it so that when they saw it. They got excited. And one last thing, the crowd, a lot of children were bringing their parents there because it was children who were finding this amazing character in Emeril and were very excited by him, just like the kids sort of led the rest of us to rock and roll way back when.
Well, it sounds like the thing you were describing as missing in those early shows was the showmanship, the yeah. fun of it. Was there a conscious decision like we've got to make a zany production out of this instead of just, you know, having people talk about food?
Well, if you read in the book, it was really an evolution, and they were worried about losing Emeril. They had some bad shows with Emeril, and they had one that was pretty good, which was his third show, Essence of Emeril. And because of the success of that, they were worried. He was the best star they had. And it was actually this sort of accidental thing that he had a cookbook coming out called Real and Rustic. And they just, this one guy who, the secret hero of the book is a guy named Joe Langan, who really founded the Food Network, started the website, and thought up Emeril Live. And they just needed to produce a special for the Real and Rustic book to make Emeril happy. And it was Joe's idea to have a live audience. And so when Emeril rushed out the first time and sort of played with a chicken and the crowd went absolutely nuts, everybody who was in that room at the time describes these shivers that ran down their spine knowing they had a hit there.
You know, it's interesting because for something as benign as cooking, the Food Network has really had its share of sort of scandals and drama over the years. And there's your book is full of so many great
yeah.
stories. I wonder if you could tell us one or two before our news break.
Well, I mean, the most recently, obviously, Paula Deen. But then you can go back to the guy that they thought was going to be the new Emeril, a guy named David Ruggiero. After his first show was on the air, unfortunately, the New York District Attorney arrested him for credit card fraud. They were his restaurant was putting like $100,000 on rich guys' credit cards. And there was a guy, Juan Carlos, I'm blanking on his name, but the Calorie Commando, and he was arrested for putting a hit out on his wife. And that's just the sort of criminal scandals and drama. There's also all these dramas about people who wanted their shows to continue and were thought to have big egos but were cut off, and the drama of all the new presidents who came and all the different owners of the Food Network and who survived and who did not survive. And you'll see in the book that the great survivor is Bobby Flay. He's the one who was able to adapt to all of the crazy circumstances. I don't want to talk over your news break, though.
That's okay. And we'll get back to him, talk more about Bobby Flay and Paula Deen and Rachel Ray. Hopefully we'll get to her as well. As we talk about the Food Network right now, we're talking to Alan Sulkin, and he's the author of From Scratch, Inside the Food Network.
We want to hear from you. Why do you think the Food Network has been such a hit? Why do we like to watch people cook stuff on the TV? Call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Do you watch the TV cooks? Do you try to do what they do, or is it just good, clean fun? You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're talking about the creation of the Food Network, the rise of the celebrity chef. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Were you a big fan? Are you a big fan of any of the Food Network chefs? Do you like watching cooking? 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
Alan Sulkin is with us now. He's the author of From Scratch, Inside the Food Network. And Alan, you mentioned Paula Deen. And, you know, of course, most recently, she is famous for sort of getting thrown off the Food Network after she used some racially sensitive language. But before that, she was sort of known as the Queen of Butter. Let's take a listen to a little bit of her old show.
What I'm fixing to do is fry up the Lady and Sons macaroni and cheese. I'm going to wrap it in bacon, and we're going to deep fry it. So here goes, y'all.
Paula Deen being Paula Deen, and that's what she did back in those days. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what her appeal was and a little bit about her fall from grace and how that happened?
Yeah, and Paula finally got on the air after 9/11. The network made a decision that it was going. Rachel Ray, her show started right after 9/11, and her ratings were so great the network realized that what people wanted was more comfort food. They didn't need quite as many chefs. They wanted personalities who could appeal to you more like a next door neighbor giving you cooking tips. And the network executives had been very resistant to Paula, thinking they didn't want this brand of sort of southernness. There was actually a lot of prejudice against the South by these New York executives. But finally, Paula's agent convinced them after 9/11 that people wanted comfort and, you know, fried chicken could fly. So that, you know, she became this sort of, you know, comforting grandma figure on the air, you know, and Giada was sort of like, you know, the girlfriend that you always wish you had, Aina was like your next door neighbor aunt or something. So anyway, Paula had that and was always able to get away with being a little kind of risque and in her public appearances. You know, using foul language. Her pants once fell down during an appearance at a festival. She was kind of this wild, like your grandma who curses a lot. You know. It was the diabetes, her announcement that she had diabetes about a year and a half ago that really started her having problems with the Food Network. They hired a crisis communications company to call reporters on the sly and start saying, we had nothing to do with this. Because the fact that she took a $6 million endorsement deal for a diabetes drug, and that's when she's made her announcement that she had diabetes, without ever telling the network she was going to do that. Now, when you listen to that clip, you know, bacon-wrapped, deep-fried macaroni and cheese, it's funny until you realize that, in a way, this is you're watching a woman sort of commit suicide on the air in front of you, and it becomes a lot less fun. To, you know, the woman with diabetes making bananas Foster with butter and a cupful of sugar.
And Anthony Bourdain made that critique of her kind of all over the place for a while.
That's right. And you know, Bourdain, whose first show was on the Food Network, people forget that, has become the cleverest and best and smartest critic of the network properly. So anyway, by the time Paula's N-word scandal hit the headlines, which was very badly managed by her team, the network basically said she's got two strikes against her. We are now a $6 billion company. We can't be in business with this kind of thing.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Patty with us in Pittsville. Patty, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Personally, I really enjoy the cooking competitions that they have on there, like Chopped. I love seeing ingredients I've never heard of being used and seeing how these chefs can think off the top of their heads. I don't particularly watch the shows that you know, where they do their cooking, like Paula Deen did.
Mm-hmm.
My mother used to enjoy those shows a lot and would take recipes and use them for family get-togethers, but I prefer the challenging ones where you see them competing.
Right. Mm. Thanks a lot, Patty, for the call. So, Alan, is that a case of the Food Network adapting with the times to the rise of reality TV?
Well, it's not just that, Patty. You know, that's why they're putting that stuff on in prime time. The what they call the dump and stir cooking show, the Julia Child format, really is losing ratings, and people are not as interested anymore. But it is important to say, just as she said, even within that competition, you can still learn about, you know, new kinds of ingredients and dragon fruit, and even for some people, still arugula. So the network is right now. I love Chopped also. However, the problem is, besides Chopped and Restaurant Impossible, they haven't got a hell of a lot that's working well in prime time.
And they're kind of late to that party, aren't they? You write about how they didn't really get on board when Top Chef hit the airwaves.
That's right, and for two reasons. They're a company that doesn't really want to take huge chances, and Top Chef was a very expensive production, and Food Network has never been a big fan of going out big. They'll spend money a little later after something hits, but they don't take those kind of gambles.
I see all over regular old network television now lots of cooking competition shows and the swearing chef telling people how to run their restaurant and fix the restaurant and things like that. Is the Food Network falling behind in its own game here?
I think the problem is they've got one foot in that, and then they've got one foot in the fact of who they really are, which is a network that got successful by presenting something comforting. If you go to a gym or a lot of situations where TV is on, it's either going to be ESPN or the Food Network on. It's this common denominator. And, you know, ESPN is just comfort food for a lot of people. And Food Network, the idea of the hearth, of watching somebody make something delicious, I think is their core brand. And the more, you know, swearing chefs they put on, possibly the more trouble they're in.
Well, the Food Network isn't really just about TV anymore. It's become a bit of an empire. These celebrity chefs, they have their own lines of cookware and spices and other shows. And Rachel Ray is a great example of that. And let's listen to a clip of her show.
Oh, look how good this looks, huh? And even if you're just making this for yourself, leftovers are killer, kids. So make a big pot. My dog, Boo, could always help eat this one, too. She loves spaghetti and meatballs. Look how good that looks. Oh, amazing.
A little bit there from Rachel Ray's show. What can you tell us about her and how she sort of exemplifies this idea of Food Network empire, Alan?
Well, Rachel isn't even making 30-minute meals anymore. That show is, they made so many, they're just putting them on in reruns. And Rachel, actually with her husband, John Cusimano, has been able to lead the way in developing a brand of, you know, knives, everything she saw on the show. People started requesting those things before there were even products, like her spaghetti pot that was long, so you could just lay the spaghetti in it. Sounds so obvious, right? But she invented that, basically. She made that a popular item, the spaghetti pot that you don't have to scrunch the spaghetti down into.
So where do you see the Food Network going from here? Are they going to sink or swim in that pot of boiling spaghetti?
I think what's going to happen, especially as there's more and more places to get programming across the Internet and everywhere else, is that the network is going to make more and more money because it is expanding internationally. It has started food networks in South Africa, in Asia, in the UK, and so it's more profitable than ever. It's a company that's making hundreds of millions of dollars a quarter, but its U.S. ratings are slipping. I think ultimately it's going to become more of a niche network, as all the networks are. Everyone is chasing number one, but the reality of the business is probably going to become back what it was going to be 20 years ago, a good, solid niche network with some devoted viewers that's probably ridden the wave of food, the expansion of food culture is almost as far as it can, and it's probably going to subside just like every wave does.
All right. Well, Alan, it's been fun. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's an honor, and thank you very much.
That was Alan Soligan, author of the book From Scratch, Inside the Food Network.
We had Steven in Lake Geneva online, by the way. He says he hates cooking, but he loves having the cooking shows on in the background. They're great white noise. Well, how about you? You can still share your thoughts at Central Time on WPR.
And you can see Alan Sulkin coming up at the Wisconsin Book Festival. You'll want to check out the website for that.